I can serve the war effort better by flying than by coaching Sproggs. He reread the letter. It sounded like a reasonable justification, one that he could present to his sister, to Nancy, to the world, although he was slightly resentful that he felt the need to justify himself when they were in the midst of battle. Hadn't he been designated the family's warrior? Although he suspected that this noble mantle might now have passed to Jimmy. The truth was that there was nothing else he wanted to do, could do. Flying on bombing raids had become him, who he was. The only place he cared about was the inside of a Halifax, the smells of dirt and oil, of sour sweat, of rubber and metal and the tang of oxygen. He wanted to be deafened by the thunder of her engines. He needed to be drained of every thought by the cold, the noise, and the equal amounts of boredom and adrenaline. He had believed once that he would be formed by the architecture of war, but now he realized he had been erased by it. He had a new crew. Gunners, Tommy and Olaf, one a Geordie, the other a Norwegian. There were quite a few Norwegians in No. 4 Group, as there were not enough of them to form their own squadron, like the Poles had done. The Norwegians were almost as fierce as the bloodthirsty Poles in their commitment. They always pressed on. They lived for the day they could fly home to a free Poland. It didn't happen, of course. He often thought of them as Poland negotiated its way through the 20th century. It was another motley crew. Sandy Worthington, his navigator, was from New Zealand. Geoffrey Smithson, his flight engineer, was a Cambridge graduate.
"Mathematics," he said solemnly, as if it was a religion.
Teddy wondered if he knew Nancy, and he said he had heard of her. She had won the Fawcett Prize, hadn't she?
"Clever girl," he said.
"Clever woman," Teddy said.
His wireless operator was Bob Booth from Leeds, and his bomb aimer was...
"G'day there, mate."
"What the hell are you doing here?" Teddy asked.
"Well, I was instructing at an OTU when I heard that the renowned Ted Todd had come back on ops early, and I thought, he's bloody well not flying without me. An Aussie squadron tried to claim me, but I pulled a few strings."
Ted had felt almost overwhelmed at the sight of Keith. He had been the one he was closest to in the old crew, and they had shared so much that they couldn't talk about with anyone else. Yet on meeting again, they had controlled themselves to a short, manly handshake of greeting. Later, as the century wore on, Teddy observed how men seemed gradually to lose constraint where their feelings were concerned, until by the time the 20th tipped into the 21st, and the advent of the unattractively named Naughties, they gave the appearance of having lost control of their emotions altogether, perhaps their senses too. Footballers and tennis players blubbing all over the place, the ordinary man in the street embracing and kissing other men on the cheeks.
"Oh, for heaven's sake, Dad," Viola said. "How can you think such crap? A stiff upper lip? Do you honestly think that the world was a better place where men kept their feelings hidden?"
"Yes."
He still sometimes remembered with horror how he had broken down in Vic Bennett's mother's kitchen. He couldn't see that it had done anyone any good, particularly him. When Nancy died, he had wept quietly and privately. It had seemed the respectful way to mourn someone.
"I blame Diana," Bertie said.
"Diana?"
"Princess. She made being hurt look heroic.
It used to be the opposite in your day."
They were sitting on top of the White Horse at Kilburn, eating sandwiches that a nice B&B landlady had packed for them at a stop on their farewell tour. Like a dog, Teddy thought, he had had his day.
"I'm too old for the world," he said.
"Me too," Bertie said.
Nancy had only been able to get one night off, and so they parted on yet another station platform, barely 24 hours after they had met on one. He had been under the impression that they would be able to spend longer together, and felt rather blue as he waved her off. But once the train had disappeared, he realized that perhaps what he felt was guilt at the relief. Keith had also come up to London on leave,
and they met up and made a congenial platonic foursome in Quaglino's with B and her friend Hanny, a refugee. They all drank a good deal, and Keith did his best to flirt with two women at once. Hanny was very pretty but seemed uninterested, and B was spoken for, engaged to a doctor, although they were both very sweet to Keith. Teddy never met B's doctor. He went over with the troops on D-Day and was killed on Gold Beach, and instead she married a surgeon after the war. B was working at the BBC, producing and doing a little continuity and some behind-the-scenes things, and Hanny worked as a translator for an obscure-sounding government department. B had moved in a medical world during the Blitz, when she had been recruited to work in a mortuary, piecing together jigsaws of body parts. Her art college background had, for some unlikely reason, deemed her suitable for this work.
"Anatomy, I suppose," she said.
Even Teddy, who had become inured to the sight of the disintegrated bodies of men, didn't think he would have had the stomach for such work. In later years, in a different age of terrorism, Teddy read about bombs in parks and nightclubs, in skyscrapers and passenger airliners, bodies blown to bits or falling to earth, and wondered if someone pieced them together again. Sylvie had always maintained that science was about men finding new ways to kill each other, and as the years went by, as if the war wasn't evidence enough, he grew to think that she was perhaps right. He danced with Hanny. She was just the right height for him, and she smelt of soie de Paris, which she said someone had brought her back from France, which made him think that she must move in rather secretive circles. Was there a woman he knew who didn't? She was wearing emerald earrings, and she hooted with laughter when he commented on them, and said, "Costume. Do I look like someone who can afford emeralds?" She had left her family behind in Germany, and wanted every single Nazi to die in agony. Fair enough, Teddy thought. The four of them arranged to meet up again the following night, and went to see Arsenic and Old Lace, which they all agreed was an excellent antidote to the war. After the war, Teddy learned from B that Hanny was with the SOE and had been parachuted into France before D-Day. Ursula and B had done their best to find out what had happened to her, because she has no one else now. It was the usual awful story. It turned out that those earrings weren't paste, but genuine emeralds, French, fin de siècle, very pretty and had belonged to her mother, who was herself French.
"And I have some Hungarian blood, as well as German, of course, and a little Romanian, even. A European mongrel." The earrings had begun their life in a goldsmith's atelier in the Marais in 1899, and, in the manner of objects, lived on long after the people who had worn them. Hanny left them with B for safekeeping. "You might not see me for a few weeks." "I think she knew she wasn't coming back," B said.
B gave them to Teddy before she died, because he was, literally, the only other person in the world who remembered Hanny. And thus it was that Bertie wore the earrings on her wedding day, a day that sadly Teddy didn't live to see. She married in winter, to the man she met by chance on Westminster Bridge, in a Saxon church in the Cotswolds, and wore antique lace and carried a bouquet of snowdrops. After some argument, she allowed Viola to give her away. It was perfect. The next day, Sunday, Keith and Teddy caught an early train to Fox Corner, where Sylvie had made a great fuss about inviting them to lunch. Keith was enthusiastic. He had visited before and charmed Sylvie. He also knew how well stocked her larder was. Ursula declined to come with them.
"Mother can have you all to herself," she said, and laughed rather wickedly.
Teddy took Keith round to Jackdaw's to meet Mrs. Shawcross, who was always keen, keener than Sylvie perhaps, to meet any members of Teddy's crew who came down to Fox Corner with him. He was able to tell her that he had seen Gertie, and Mrs. Shawcross said,
"How exciting, but I worry about her so. One thinks about Amy Johnson, you know."
Millie was briefly in residence, and flirted outrageously with Keith.
That girl ought to be chained up,
he laughed when they finally escaped her clutches.
Not my type, he said.
He was still rather smitten with Hanny, Bee's friend.
Can't imagine taking her back to the sheep station, though, he said.
Keith never doubted that he will be going back to Australia, and Teddy took a lot of comfort from his certainty.
She's Jewish, you know, Keith said.
I know.
First Jewish person I've met, Keith said, as if amazed.
Jewess,
Sylvie would have said.
It must be nice to fall in love, he added, revealing a surprisingly romantic side. Follow your heart and all that.
Steady on, Teddy said. You're beginning to sound like a matinee idol. Or a woman. Months later, Teddy himself fell in love. He followed his heart, and it led him up a blind alley, a dead end. But he didn't mind that much. A romantic interlude. Julia. She was tall and fair, neither of which were attributes that Teddy usually found attractive in a woman.
A natural blonde, she pointed out.
I don't think I've ever met one of those, Teddy said.
Now you have, she said, and laughed. She threw her head back when she laughed in a way that could have been crude but was actually charming. She wasn't one of those women who covered their mouths when they laughed, but then she had nice teeth, creamy and very pearly.
Good breeding, she said. Good dentistry, too.
She laughed a lot. She had been to school with Stella, and Stella had told Teddy to look Julia up when he was in London, which was selfless of Stella.
Don't fall in love with her, she warned, priming the pump. She's broken the hearts of better men than you.
Even though Stella didn't know a better man than Teddy. Teddy didn't want to die without falling in love, and as he expected to die at any given moment, he undoubtedly forced the hand of Cupid into giving him a taste of wartime romance. He was ripe for it. Julia was in the ATS, working in a garage in central London, driving army lorries. There was always a smear of oil or grease on her, and her fingernails were filthy. Nonetheless, she always turned heads. It came as naturally to her as the blonde hair. She was the sort of girl who always had good restaurant tables, good theatre seats, the sort of girl who people gave things to. There was something dazzling about her, a kind of glamour that spelled people. Spelled Teddy, for one whole week. She wangled some leave after their first dinner together, first night together, too. No point in hanging about, darling, she said, unbuttoning his uniform jacket. She was the kind of girl who could wangle leave.
Pa knows everyone.
Pa was an advisor to the government, whatever that meant, but let his only golden child run wild and free. She was 22, not a child. Mummy was dead.
So sad.
Julia had pots of money. Pa was also a lord. Teddy had been at school with the sons of plenty of lords and wasn't put off by her breeding, although he couldn't help but be a little impressed by the enormous mansion near Regent's Park that was the family's London house. They had an ancestral pile in Northamptonshire and a place in Ireland.
Oh, and an apartment in Paris that some disgusting Gauleiter is currently occupying.
Pa had moved out, staying somewhere in Westminster, and Julia had a flat in Petit France. The London house was shut up for the duration. Everything had simply been left where it was, shrouded in dust sheets. The enormous chandeliers still hung from the ceilings beneath their covers, looking like awkwardly wrapped presents. Valuable paintings had cloths hung over them, as if the house was in mourning. An odd assortment of dust sheets and old bed linen, and some not so old, had been flung over the furniture. Teddy discovered a Louis XV couch beneath a candlewick counterpane, a magnificent Louis XIV boule commode draped in a sheet, a writing desk that had apparently belonged to Marie Antoinette, with an eiderdown stuck on top of it. He found a Gainsborough beneath a tea towel. He fretted for their safety. "Aren't you worried about these things?"
"Worried?"
It wasn't a word in her vocabulary. She was criminally carefree. It was what attracted him to her.
That someone will steal them, or they'll be destroyed by a bomb.
Julia just shrugged and said,
"We have loads of this kind of stuff."
He lifted the veil on a small Rembrandt every time he passed it on the staircase. No one would miss it, he thought. Did such careless people even deserve such treasure? If he took the Rembrandt, his life would be quite different. He would be a thief, for one thing. A different narrative. There were a couple of Rubens, a Van Dyck, a Bernini in the hall, all kinds of Italian Renaissance treasures. But it was the little Rembrandt that stole his heart. He could have robbed the entire house. There was a key beneath an urn at the front door. When he chided Julia for the lack of security, she laughed and said,
"Yes, but it's a very heavy urn."
It was.
"You can have it as far as I'm concerned, darling," Julia said when she caught him looking at the Rembrandt. "It's a murky old thing."
"Thank you, but no." What a pillar of moral rectitude. In later life, he wished he had appropriated the painting. No one would have believed it was a genuine Rembrandt. It would have existed entirely for his own guilty pleasure, hanging on a suburban wall. He should have done. The London house was hit by a V2. The Rembrandt lost forever.
"You can keep your art as far as I'm concerned," Julia said. "I'm very shallow, I'm afraid."
In Teddy's experience, people who claimed to be one thing were generally the opposite, although in Julia's case, it was true. She was magnificently Philistine. They didn't go to Petit France. Instead, they spent their romantic interlude in the London house, or on one memorable night in which sleep played no part, at a suite in the Savoy that seemed to be permanently available to her. There were gallons of champagne in the cellar of the London house, and they spent the week drinking it and making love on top of a variety of priceless antiques. It struck Teddy that it was possible that Julia lived her life like this all the time. She had a perfect body, the Grecian goddess type. He could imagine her as a goddess, cool and indifferent, quite happy to condemn some poor Actaeon to be torn to death by hounds. Nancy could never inhabit the cruel world of Olympus. She was more of a merry pagan sprite.
"Who is Nancy?"
"My fiancée."
"Oh, darling, how sweet!"
He was rather put out by her response. The piquancy of a little jealousy would have added to the whole experience. That's what it was, an experience. His heart was never truly engaged. He was playing at romance. This was after Hamburg, after Beethoven, after Keith died, not long before Nuremberg, when he didn't care too much about anything, particularly beautiful shallow blondes. But he appreciated the gift of having unfettered, lusty sex. Filthy, as Julia put it. So that in later years, when he returned to the more common or garden type, he at least knew what it was to fuck with abandon. He wasn't fond of the word, but it was the only one that would do for Julia, really. On the last day of his leave, he turned up at the London house and shifted the heavy urn to find no key, only a piece of paper bearing a scribbled message.
"Darling, it was lovely. See you around. J. Kiss, kiss."
He rather resented being locked out of the house. He had begun to feel quite at home there. Not long afterwards, Julia was posted to an army ordnance base and was one of 17 people who were killed when a bomb dump accidentally exploded. Teddy was already in the POW camp by then and didn't find out about this incident until years later, when he read about her father's death in his own newspaper. "Pierre in sex scandal falls to death." He imagined Julia's perfect white limbs broken and scattered like ancient statuary. It was old news, too old for him really to care. Nancy had just embarked on her illness. He hadn't known about the London house either until he read it in the same newspaper article. "Many priceless works of art lost during the war." He mourned the little Rembrandt more than he did Julia, who he hadn't thought of for a long time. But that was in the future. Now he was returning from Jackdaw's with Keith, and finding Fox Corner's drawing room alive with guests. Sylvie had invited people for lunch, people Teddy had never met, and in whom he had little interest. There was a pontificating local councillor and his wife, a solicitor, a self-styled old-fashioned bachelor, who seemed to be lining himself up as a prospective suitor for Sylvie. There was also a widow, rather elderly, who complained a good deal, particularly about how hard the war had made her life. And finally, a man of the cloth, as Sylvie referred to him. Not just an ordinary cleric, but a bishop, a superior kind of devil-dodger. He was rather unctuous, as Teddy expected a bishop to be. They were drinking dainty glasses of sherry, the men too, and Sylvie said to Keith and Teddy, "I expect you would prefer beer."
"I wouldn't say no to a jar, Mrs. T," Keith replied, at his most affably Australian.
Sylvie seemed to have assembled a cast list of characters for a banal farce. It was the kind of bourgeois society that she had little time for, usually, and Teddy couldn't work out why she had chosen to broaden her social circle with the great and the good of the parish. It was only when she started making a performance out of pointing out his medal ribbons and boasting about his brave deeds, even though he had told her virtually nothing about his deeds, brave or otherwise, that he began to suspect that she was showing him off to this collection of worthies. He found he had absolutely nothing to say when they urged him to recount some of his feats of daring do, and it was left to Keith to entertain them with humorous accounts of their exploits, so that the war began to sound like a series of madcap escapades, rather like one of Augustus's adventures.
"But still," the bachelor said, in search of something more barbaric, "it's not all fun and games. You've certainly been bombing the daylights out of Jerry."
"Yes, well done," the local councillor said pompously. "A good show. Hamburg has been a great success for the RAF, hasn't it?"
"Yes, well done, lads," the bishop said, making a slight toasting gesture with his sherry glass. "Now let's get the rest of them."
"All of them?" Teddy wondered.
"I should warn you," Ursula had written to Teddy, "that the pig has been killed."
Teddy had met Sylvie's pig on several occasions since its arrival as a rotund pink piglet. He had rather admired the pig. It had no pretensions to grandeur, snuffling and truffling around in its not-together pen, grateful for any scraps that came its way. And now, apparently, the poor creature was being packaged up as bacon and sausages and ham, and all the other products that a pig was destined to be in its afterward. To be hawked around for money by Spivvy Sylvie, presumably. They were to eat roast leg of pork with vegetables from the garden, and apple sauce bottled from last autumn's apples, and a queen of puddings, provided mostly by the overworked chickens. Teddy couldn't help but think of the pig when it was alive, still in possession of four sturdy legs.
"Everything from Fox Corner," Sylvie said proudly, "from the pig on the table to the jam and eggs in the pudding."
Perhaps she was advertising her household economy to the bachelor, or the bishop. Teddy couldn't imagine his mother remarrying. She had settled into a rather stout, self-satisfied middle age, and enjoyed having her own way.
"That's a smell to raise a man's spirits," the bishop said,
raising his refined episcopal nose to sniff the roasting pig.
"You're very ingenious to be so self-sufficient, my dear," the solicitor said to Sylvie,
draining his sherry from the tiny glass and looking round hopefully for a decanter.
"There should be medals for women on the home front," the councillor's wife grumbled, "for our ingenuity, if not for everything we have to suffer."
A remark that provoked more grousing from the elderly widow.
"Suffering? Tell me about it."
Teddy felt himself growing hot and restless.
"Excuse me for a moment," he said,
putting his glass of beer down.
"All right, mate,"
Keith said as he pushed past him.
"Just need a bit of air," Teddy said.
"Off to have a smoke,"
he heard Keith say, making an excuse for him. Teddy whistled for the dog, which he found outside, intent on studying the chickens safely interned behind the wire in their run. Lucky, obedient to the last, followed Teddy into the lane. The dog slipped beneath the gate into the dairy herd's field, and then stopped in bewilderment at the sight of the cows.
"Cows," Teddy said. "They won't hurt you," he added.
But the dog began barking wildly. He was both nervous and defiant, a mixture that was unsettling to the normally easy-going cows, and Teddy retrieved the dog before he could cause any trouble. Hamburg had been a good show, he reflected. There had been perfect flying conditions in the run-in over the North Sea, and the Germans had jammed the wrong G-chain so that the navigators were able to get reliable fixes on the target from the radio navigation system.
Let's talk about something more interesting than the mechanics of bombing.
After the long journey over the featureless dark of the North Sea, it had been a relief to reach the German coast and see the route markers dropped by the pathfinders, golden candles of fire spilling gracefully and dripping to earth, marking their wicket gate, gathering and shepherding them towards the straight and narrow way of the bomb run. It had been emphasized to them at the briefing that the bomber stream needed to pack itself tightly, not only to concentrate the bombing, but also so that window, which they were using for the first time, could protect as many of them as possible. There had been some skepticism about the mysterious window, and in the briefing you would have thought that the boffins had come up with the Holy Grail. But in the event, the crews were all as pleased as punch with it. Window was their new secret weapon, a kind of aluminium chaff. Some aircraft had already been modified with a special chute, but most, like Q Queenie, were still using their flare chute to deploy window. It was a wretched job, and Teddy had sent a very resentful Keith down to the freezing fuselage, where, hampered by his portable oxygen bottle as well as a torch and a stopwatch, he had to perch next to the flare chute, where, every 60 seconds, he had to remove the elastic from the awkward bundles and post them out of the aircraft. But oh, the beauty of them! Those long, silvery streamers that fell to earth and snowed up the German ground radar so that their fighters couldn't be vectored onto the bombers. They could see the searchlights roaming aimlessly around the sky, while the blue master beam stood to helpless attention. The German AK-AK guns had nothing to aim at, so as they approached the city itself, there was only a barrage of flak sent up in blind hope, like firecrackers on bonfire night. They had reached the target without acquiring any real damage. And what a target! 2,300 tons of bombs and over 350,000 incendiaries in an hour. A world record. The first target indicators, dropped over the city by the pathfinders, were fountains of red and gold, showering the earth below. And they were followed by lovely green ones, so that the overall effect was of jeweled fireworks cascading in the black sky. The coloured lights were joined by the bright, quick flashes of the high explosive and the larger, slower explosions of the 4,000-pound cookies, and everywhere there was the enchanting twinkling of white lights as thousands upon thousands of incendiaries rained down on the city. The intention was for the heavy bombs to blow open the buildings, taking the roofs off so that the incendiaries could fall and start fires, turning the buildings into fiercely burning chimneys. That's what bombers did. They set fire to whatever was on the earth below them. It was tinder dry in the city, hardly any humidity, perfect conditions for finally showing Hitler and the British government what Bomber Command could do. Q Queenie had gone in on the second wave, behind the Pathfinders and the Lancasters, who had already lit up the target for them. It was like Christmas, the glitter and sparkle of incendiaries speckling the sky. Red fires were glowing everywhere, although they soon began to be obscured by a dark pall of smoke. Keith talked them in, to the centre of this pyrotechnic display.
"Left, right, right a bit more,"
until Teddy heard him say,
"Bombs away!"
And they made for home, as another four waves of bombers were still making their unharried way to the target. They went to Essen the next night, another maximum effort, and then were stood down for a much-needed 24 hours while the Americans took over, two daylight raids on Hamburg, one after the other, stoking the fires with incendiaries and creating more with their high explosives. Teddy felt sorry for the American flyers. Travelling in tight formation in daylight, they took the brunt of the German defences. Q Queenie had made an emergency landing at Shipdom USAF base a few weeks ago, and they had been given a rousing welcome. They hardly ever came across their Allied counterparts, so it was heartening to find themselves in the midst of an American squadron, whose flyers were, as Tommy their Geordie put it, just like us. Except shinier and newer. The gloss not quite as worn off, although it soon would be. And with much, much better food, so that when she eventually returned to her own station, Q Queenie was laden with chocolate and cigarettes, canned fruit and goodwill. The weather on their stand-down had been good, and the crews lounged in lawn chairs or set up card tables outside. Someone organized a cricket match in an adjacent field, a rough, enjoyable game, but many simply slept, worn out by war. Teddy and Keith went for a long, lazy bike ride with a couple of WAFs, Lucky lolloping beside them. When he got tired, he was put in the basket on the front of one of the WAF's bikes, where he sat like a proud figurehead, his ears flattened by the breeze. "In the cockpit," the WAF said. Edith, a chop girl, you couldn't help feeling sorry for. The last three aircrew she had dated had failed to return from ops, and now no one will go near her. In a darker moment, Teddy had considered sleeping with her, just to see what would happen to him afterwards. Perhaps he still would, he thought. She was keen on him, but then all the WAFs were. They ate fish-paste sandwiches and drank water from a stream, and it was as if the Third Reich didn't exist, and England was restored to her green and pleasant self. He checked his watch. 3 o'clock. They would have eaten lunch at Fox Corner without him. He hoped so, anyway. He had left Keith in their unholy clutches long enough, he supposed. They crossed the meadow in full summer regalia, flax and larkspur, buttercups, corn poppies, red campion and oxeye daisies, and skirted the edges of one of the home farm's big wheat fields. The wheat glimmered and undulated in the breeze. He had often worked on the harvest in these fields, punctuated by beer and cheese lunches with the farmhands beneath a hot sun. Hard to believe life was so simple once. He remembered it now as a romantic pre-war idyll. "You sunburnt sicklemen of August weary, come hither from the furrow and be merry." But he supposed for the farmhands there was no Shakespearean pastoral to be found in their toiling, and the harvest was just another turn of the agricultural year, and its never-ending, grinding labour. There was a scattering of poppies amongst the wheat, red spots of blood amongst the gold, and he thought of those other fields in that other war, his father's war, and felt a great fall inside himself at the memory of Hugh. He wished his father was in Fox Corner, waiting for his return with a glass of beer in the garden, or a tumbler of whiskey in the growlery. The dog had bounded off into the middle of the wheat, and he could no longer see it, but he could hear it barking with excitement. Not nervous now, so it must have found some creature less threatening than a cow, a rabbit, or a harvest mouse. Teddy whistled so that the dog could keep its bearings and navigate its way out of the field.
"Time to go," he said, when it finally scampered back.
"We thought we'd lost you,"
Sylvie said crossly.
"Not yet," Teddy said. "All right?"
Keith asked, handing him a glass of beer. Keith was sitting on the terrace, looking very at home. The great and the good appeared to have left. He decided to spend the last night of his leave with Ursula. Keith was off on the razzle with some of his fellow countrymen. Teddy walked through the parks, and then took up a sentry post outside Ursula's office, and waited to surprise her when she came out from work.
"Teddy!"
"The very same."
"And Lucky! What a treat to see him!"
Again, Teddy felt himself coming in second to the dog. Lucky was beside himself at seeing Ursula again.
"This is good timing," she said, "or perhaps you'll think it bad.
How do you feel about chumming me along to the proms? I've got two tickets, and the friend who was coming with me has had to drop out. We can eat afterwards.
Splendid, Teddy said,
groaning inwardly at the idea of attending a concert, possibly the last thing he felt like doing. The sea air and his 24-hour furlough with Nancy, not to mention the lunch at Fox Corner, had drained him of whatever reserve of energy he had left, and he would rather have gone to a cinema and fallen asleep in the foggy dark, or perhaps drunk the night into oblivion somewhere pleasantly unchallenging.
Oh, good,
Ursula said. She decided to leave the dog in her office.
Against the rules, I expect, she said cheerfully.
But there will be a lot of people working through the night, and he'll be spoiled rotten. Lucky was a pragmatic dog, and immediately attached himself to one of the secretaries. It was a beautiful evening, and they enjoyed the short walk along to the Royal Albert Hall. They were early, and there was still plenty of sunshine to warm them in Kensington Gardens, where they took a seat on a bench and ate the remains of Ursula's lunchtime sandwiches that she hadn't had time to finish because she'd had to run up and down to Whitehall.
All I do, really, is move paper around. I think it's what most people do. Not you, of course.
Thank goodness, Teddy said, remembering the tedium of the bank. If by some chance he survived the war, what on earth was he going to do? The idea of an afterward filled him with dread. His sister stood up and brushed crumbs off her skirt.
Best get going. Don't want to keep Beethoven waiting.
They had good seats, the tickets given to Ursula by someone. She had hoped to bring her friend, Miss Wolfe, but she'd had to cancel.
It's very sad, Ursula said. She's just learned that her nephew in the army has been killed in North Africa. Miss Wolfe is a simply splendid person, a shining star, and she is a great believer in the power of music to heal. And to hear Beethoven in the midst of war, especially this Beethoven, would have pleased her enormously.
Which Beethoven, Teddy wondered. He read the program notes. The 9th. The BBC Symphony Concert Orchestra with the Alexandra Choir, Adrian Bolt conducting.
Alle Menschen werden Brüder,
Ursula said.
Do you think it's possible, one day, that all men could be brothers one day? People, by which I largely mean men, have been killing each other since time began, since Cain threw a rock at Abel's head, or whatever it was he did to him. I don't think the Bible's that specific, Teddy said. We have terrifically tribal instincts, Ursula said. We're all primitives underneath. That's why we had to invent God, to be the voice of our conscience, or we would be killing each other left, right, and center. I think that's what we are doing.
The auditorium was rapidly filling up, people shuffling in, and they had to move their knees to one side several times to let people pass. Down below, the promenaders were jockeying politely for good spots in the arena.
These are rather good seats, Teddy said.
Whatever man gave you them must like you a lot.
Yes, but they're not the best seats,
Ursula said, seeming to find this remark very amusing.
Those were huge raids last week, she said unexpectedly,
the non-sequitur knocking him off balance.
Yes. Do you think Hamburg is finished?
Yes. No, I don't know. Probably. From 17,000 feet, you can't see much. Just fire.
The choir began to take their places.
They took a real hammering,
Ursula continued.
They? The people. In Hamburg.
Teddy didn't think of them as people. They were towns. They were factories and railway yards, fighter stations, docks.
Do you ever have any doubts?
She persisted.
Doubts? You know, about area bombing. Area bombing?
It was a term he had heard, but not one that he had given a great deal of thought to.
Indiscriminate attacks. The civilian population considered to be a legitimate target. Innocent people. It doesn't make you feel uncomfortable.
He turned and looked at her, astonished by her bluntness.
Uncomfortable. We don't target civilians. Can you devise a war where no one is killed? We have to destroy their industry, their economy, if we're to win. Their housing too, if necessary. We're doing what's been asked of us to defend our country, to defend freedom. We're waging war against a deadly foe, and we're risking our lives every time we fly.
He could hear himself slipping into rhetoric, and grew irritated, more with himself than Ursula, for surely she of all people understood the concept of duty.
"Now let's get the rest of them," Sylvie's bishop had said yesterday.
"And how do you define innocent, anyway?" he pressed on. "Workers in factories that are making bombs, or guns, or aircraft, or steel, or ball bearings, or tanks? The Gestapo? Hitler?"
He was most definitely into hyperbole now.
"And let's not forget it was the Germans who started this war."
"I rather think we started it at Versailles,"
Ursula said quietly. Teddy sighed, regretting his choleric response. Methinks he doth protest too much.
"Sometimes," he said, "I think if only I could go back in time and shoot Hitler, or better still, kill him at birth."
"But then I suppose," Ursula said, "you could keep going back, unpicking history all the way, until you arrived at Cain and Abel again." "Or the apple."
"Shh," someone said crossly, as the first violinist made his way onto the platform. They joined in the applause, relieved to end the conversation. Ursula put her hand on his arm and whispered,
"I'm sorry. I haven't lost faith in the war. I just wondered how you felt. If you were, you know, all right."
"Of course I am."
Teddy was grateful when, to much acclaim, Bolt appeared. A great silence fell. Ursula should congratulate him, not raise doubts. Operation Gomorrah was considered an enormous success by the crews. It was a turning point. It would push the war nearer to its conclusion. It would help those troops, the brown bodies, who at some future date were going to have to land again on European soil and battle their way to the end.
"A good prang,"
his flight engineer, Jeff Smithson, had written in his logbook.
"A good show,"
the solicitor said yesterday, slavering in anticipation of the poor pig. The crews had been pleased, Teddy thought, glancing at his sister, now utterly absorbed in the music. Surely everyone was. Later, much later, long after the war was over, he learned that it had been a firestorm. He had not heard that word, not during the war. He learned that they had been sent deliberately to residential districts, that people were boiled in fountains and baked in cellars. They were burnt alive or suffocated. They were reduced to ash or melted fat. They were trapped like flies on flypaper as they tried to cross the molten tarmac of the streets where they lived. A good prang.
"An eye for an eye,"
Max said at the squadron reunion. Until everyone was blind, Teddy wondered. Gomorrah, Armageddon, an Old Testament god of spite and vengeance. Once they started, there was no going back. Hamburg wasn't a turning point, it was a staging post. In the end, it led to Tokyo. It led to Hiroshima. And then later, the whole argument about innocence became irrelevant, when you could flick a switch on one continent and destroy thousands on another. At least Cain had to look at Abel's face. The RAF had gone back for a second innings on the Tuesday night, and found the city still ablaze, one vast inferno, like a glowing incandescent carpet spread across the landscape, smothering everything beneath it. It was like flying over an immense volcano containing the fiery heart of hell, from which violent explosions would occasionally erupt. The city of destruction. Its ferocity, its terrible, awful beauty, almost returned poetry to Teddy. A medieval apocalypse, he thought.
"Navigator, come and look at this," he said, persuading Sandy Worthington out from behind his curtain. "You'll never see anything like it again."
Keith didn't need to direct them in. They could see the conflagration from many miles away, and as they flew over the boiling, bubbling cauldron of flames, he said,
"Let's put another shovelful of coal on the fire, shall we, Skipper?"
A filthy, dense column of smoke rose as high as the aircraft, and they could feel the tremendous heat rising up from below. They could smell the smoke through their oxygen masks, and something else, even less welcome. And when they landed back at the squadron, they discovered that Q Queenie's perspex was covered in a thin film of soot. The smoke and the soot of the fire had risen up to meet them thousands of feet in the air. And the something else, something that Teddy would never forget, something he could never talk about, the smell of burning flesh rising from the pyre. He knew then in his secret heart that one day a reckoning would come due. Sometimes a German fighter would infiltrate the bomber stream as it made its way back across the North Sea, a particularly mean trick. It might pick off an aircraft as it headed home, or even as it came into land, just as safety was at hand. A few weeks after the Battle of Hamburg, after dodging and weaving for months, Q Queenie was finally caught on the way back from a raid on Berlin. It had been a long, hard struggle to get back from the big city, and they were all sleepy and cold. They had eaten their chocolate, drunk their coffee, taken their wakey-wakey pills, and it was a great relief when they finally saw the red light on top of the church spire in the village nearest to the airfield. Teddy presumed the light was there to prevent them crashing into the spire, but they always regarded it as a beacon guiding them home. The flare path was lit up, and they heard the cheery tones of a WAF in the control tower clearing them to land. But no sooner had she spoken than the flare path was extinguished, the airfield plunged into darkness, and the call sign for intruders was broadcast. Teddy switched off Q Queenie's lights and pulled back on the controls to take her up again. Somewhere, anywhere but there, because he could see tracer fire crossing in front of them, and the gunners were yelling that there was a bandit. But neither of them seemed to know where he was, and their guns were hosing all over the sky. There was no sky to corkscrew down into, not enough speed to do anything. And he thought perhaps the best thing he could do was just land any old how, pancake down on whatever was below them. Before he could do anything, Q Queenie was pummeled by cannon fire from the fighter. It must have hit her in the undercarriage because they landed on one wheel and she tipped over, one wing high, the other digging into the ground, and they left the runway and screamed through a field before hitting a tree that they all swore had never been there before, but was real enough to flip them over, like a giant insect, and the world inside Q Queenie was turned upside down. There were a lot of groans coming from behind Teddy, but they were the groans of people who had been thrown around, bruised and battered, not mortally wounded. He could hear a lot of angry Norwegian. Only Keith was silent, and Sandy Worthington and their Geordie mid-upper kicked open the bottom, now top, escape hatch, and helped to drag him through it. As they exited the topsy-turvy aircraft, the flare-path lights came back on, and Teddy was surprised to see that they were still within the boundary of the airfield, and the blood wagon and fire engine were already racing out to them. Apart from the fact that they were upside down, or perhaps because of it, it was a miraculous landing. For this brave deed, he added to the fruit salad of ribbons on his uniform, a bar to go with his DFC. Keith had lost a lot of blood. He'd been hit by the cannon fire before they crashed. He was deathly silent, although his eyes were half open, and his little finger was fluttering. No last words.
"Well, good luck to you, then."
They laid him on the ground, and Teddy pulled him onto his lap and held him in his arms, awkwardly, a brutal pietà. Keith's luck had ceased to be Widdershins and had become ordinary rotten stuff, and it had run out. Teddy knew he wasn't going to last more than a few seconds, and saw the moment when the finger stopped fluttering, and the half-open eyes lost the light. And he was sorry that he couldn't think of anything to say to Keith that might have made him feel better about leaving this life. But there wasn't anything, really, was there? When he got back to his quarters, Teddy stripped off his bloody uniform and emptied the pockets. His cigarettes, the silver hair, and finally the tardily taken photograph of himself and Nancy and the dog on the promenade by the sea. A smear across the top, still wet. Keith's blood. It seemed precious, like a relic.
"Tea,"
he told his granddaughter when she asked about it. Not because she wouldn't have been interested, but because it was a private thing. He showed his feelings to the dog alone, pressing his face into the fur of its neck to stifle his emotions. It suffered for a while, and then struggled out of his arms.
"Sorry,"
Teddy said, pulling himself together. But that was several weeks away yet, in the future. Now, in the present, in the Royal Albert Hall, Beethoven was performing his secret ministry on Teddy. Teddy resolved to simply feel the music, and stopped searching for words to describe it. And by the time the fourth movement came around and Roy Henderson, the baritone, began to sing, "O Freude," the hairs on the back of his neck were standing up. In her seat beside him, Ursula was almost quivering with the power of emotion, like a coiled spring, a bird ready to rise from the ground at any moment. Towards the end of the final movement, when the magnificence of the chorale becomes almost unbearable, Teddy had the odd sensation that he might actually have to hold on to his sister to prevent her rising into the air and taking flight. They left the Albert Hall and walked into the balmy evening. They were silent for a long time as the dusk gathered around them.
"Numinous,"
Ursula said, breaking the silence eventually.
"There's a spark of the divine in the world. Not God, we're done with God, but something. Is it love? Not silly romantic love, but something more profound. I think it's perhaps something we don't have a name for," Teddy said. "We want to name everything. Perhaps that's where we've gone wrong. And whatsoever Adam called every living creature, that was the name thereof. Having dominion over everything has been a terrible curse."
Afterwards, because it turned out that there was to be an afterwards for Teddy, he resolved that he would try always to be kind. It was the best he could do. It was all that he could do. And it might be love, after all. 1960. His little unremembered acts of kindness and of love. It had begun with a headache, a terrible one, in the middle of the school day. This was before they moved to York, and Nancy was still teaching at the Secondary Modern in Leeds. A wretched Monday in winter, a raw east wind and precious little daylight.
"A bit under the weather,"
Nancy said, when Teddy remarked over breakfast that she looked peaky. At lunchtime she went to the sick room, and the school nurse gave her a couple of aspirin, but they had no effect, and she had to abandon teaching the first period of the afternoon, and instead took up residence in the sick room.
"Sounds like a migraine,"
the school nurse said authoritatively. "Just lie down in the dark and rest." So she did, on the sick room's uncomfortable little camp bed, with its scratchy red blanket, the usual occupants of which were teenage girls with period pains. After half an hour or so, she struggled to a sitting position and vomited all over the red blanket.
"Oh, God, I am so sorry,"
she said to the nurse.
"Definitely a migraine," the nurse said.
She was the maternal sort, and after cleaning up, she patted Nancy's hand and said,
"You'll soon be as right as ninepence."
She did feel a bit better after being sick, and was well enough to drive home to Aswick, rather cautiously, before the end of the school afternoon, although it felt as if a swarm of bees was busy inside her head. When Nancy arrived home, Viola was already there with Ellen Crowther. Mrs. Crowther was the local woman they had employed to pick up Viola from the village primary school and wait with her until one or other of them returned from work. Mrs. Crowther's own brood was grown and gone, but she had a husband, who was a farmhand, and an ancient father-in-law, the old man, both of whom sounded more demanding than any child, even Viola. She was a witchy-looking woman, thinning black hair scraped into a knot, and a twisted expression due to some childhood palsy. Despite these attributes, she seemed rather characterless, worn away by service and obedience. "Do you like Mrs. Crowther?" Nancy once asked Viola, and Viola gave her a puzzled look and said, "Mrs. who?" Usually, by the time Nancy got home, Mrs. Crowther was ready to leave, wrapped up in headscarf and brown-belted gabardine mac, and out of the door like a greyhound from a trap, before Nancy had time to say hello. Her husband, and perhaps the old man too, seemed to be a stickler for punctuality, particularly when it came to tea being on the table.
"I'll get a row if I'm late,"
were Mrs. Crowther's usual words as she dashed off. Arriving home earlier than usual, the bees still diligently at work in her head, Nancy must have entered the house more quietly than she realized, as neither Viola nor Mrs. Crowther noticed her. Even Bobby the dog failed to greet her. Viola was sitting at the big farmhouse table reading Bunty, holding a ham sandwich in one hand while twirling a lock of hair around a finger on the other, a surprisingly irritating habit that they had been unable to break her of. Mrs. Crowther was writing what looked like a shopping list in a stubby joiner's pencil on the back of an envelope, a cup of tea to hand. Nancy felt oddly affected by this domestic tableau, the peaceful ordinariness of it, perhaps, the knitted cosy on the teapot, the way Mrs. Crowther was stirring the sugar in her cup without taking her eyes off her shopping list, the frown of concentration on Viola's face as she assiduously ate her way through her sandwich while lost in this week's adventure of the Four Marys. For a moment, as she stood unseen in the doorway, Nancy experienced a sudden, odd sense of detachment. She was invisible, an observer, looking in on a life that she was somehow barred from. She began to feel dangerously untethered, as if she might simply float away at any moment and not be able to get back to where she belonged. She started to feel panic, but at that moment Viola looked up from her comic and spotted her.
"Mummy!"
she exclaimed, her face lighting up. The spell was broken, and Nancy crossed the threshold and entered the safety of the kitchen, the old Arga throwing out comfort and warmth to welcome her. Mrs. Crowther said,
"Goodness, you gave me a fright standing there. For a minute I thought you were a ghost. You're as white as any ghost would be," she added, as if she was familiar with spirits. "Are you feeling all right? Here, sit down. Let me pour you a cup of tea."
"I had a migraine at school," Nancy said, sinking into a chair at the table.
The bees moved restlessly in her head, behind her eyes. Mrs. Crowther poured the tea, and before Nancy could protest, she stirred 3 spoonfuls of sugar into the cup.
"Hot sweet tea," Mrs. Crowther said. "Just what you need."
It was strange being ministered to by someone who was normally a blur of gabardine in the hallway. Mrs. Crowther proved to have unsuspected reservoirs of small talk.
"Thank you,"
Nancy said, enormously grateful for the tea, even with its heavy charge of sugar.
"You're home early,"
Viola said. She was suspicious of any change in routine, disliking spontaneity. Was it because she was an only child, or simply a child?
"Yes, darling, I am."
When the tea was drunk, and on Mrs. Crowther's recommendation she had eaten a rich tea biscuit to settle her stomach,
"Works a treat, doesn't it?"
she said to Mrs. Crowther,
"I know it's an imposition, but would you mind hanging on until my husband gets home? I think I might go and lie down."
She must have fallen fast asleep. When she woke, it was dark, but the bedroom door was open and the light was on in the hall. The bees were silenced, gone to find a new queen. The clock by the bed said 9 o'clock. She felt thick-headed,
but much better.
Hello, you,